This is the Politics and More podcast. I'm David Remnick. It's been a very strange spring, to say the very least. So many of us are stuck inside as tulips emerge from the dirt and birdsong erupts from outside, all those signs of life returning after the winter. So we'll start the show today with one of the great thinkers about the relationship between people and nature, Bill McKibben, who's at home in the woods of Vermont.
I'm Bill McKibben, and I'm a writer. And, you know, I spend a lot of my life working on the big crisis of our time, the climate crisis. And so, of course, the last few weeks, I've been watching with great sadness and great interest as we try to deal with this crisis that has befallen us right now, the coronavirus, and thinking about the ways in which it overlaps with the other bigger ongoing dramas on our planet. Okay, we're just wandering down the driveway to the little marsh at the end because the last few nights the wood frogs have suddenly appeared. Their raucous spring ritual. And here's just this little swampy marsh. Now the wood frogs will be quiet for a little while because they can hear us coming and they get a little nervous, but I bet if we stand over there quietly for a minute, the sound of the wood frogs will start to pick up again. Let's see. We may have to back farther away. There's no possible way to get past the sadness of this moment. It, you know, haunts everybody all the time. But it is good sometimes to be able to remind yourself that the world, the planet, at least for now, goes on about its appointed mission. I mean, the wood frogs are very intent on mating with each other. They have not thrown in the towel. And also to be out at night and be reminded that we're a small part of something very, very, very large. That doesn't make it any better that people are dying or sad or unemployed or so on, but it does maybe help me anyway get through to the next day a little bit.
Bill McKibben in Vermont. Bill's joining us this week as we're marking an important anniversary. 50 years ago, April 22, 1970, people across the country gathered to demand government action on pollution. This was the first Earth Day, and something like 20 million Americans, a tenth of the population at the time, turned out for it.
Good evening. A unique day in American history is ending, a day set aside for a nationwide outpouring of mankind seeking its own survival. Earth Day.
It was as if Washington knew it was a special event and turned on spring's brightest sun for the celebration of Earth Day in a march on the Interior Department.
You probably know the story. The momentum of that first Earth Day helped lead to landmark legislation, the Clean Air and the Clean Water Acts. Richard Nixon, of all people, created the Environmental Protection Agency that very same year. And now, 50 years later, the situation is entirely different. The Trump administration has weakened the Endangered Species Act, withdrawn from the Paris Climate Accord, and much more. Just a few weeks ago, it rolled back auto emissions standards, and there's a move now to ease controls on the amount of mercury that's released by power plants. But there's no protest march this Earth Day, because, of course, people can't gather. And so, as Bill McKibben said earlier, we now face two devastating global crises at once: the climate crisis that's been building for decades, and the coronavirus pandemic that's ripped through the world in a matter of months. I called up Bill along with staff writer Elizabeth Colbert, who's covered climate change and extinction for The New Yorker for more than 20 years. I asked Betsy about the administration's latest rollback of environmental regulations and why now.
They're actually up against an interesting deadline. So if there's a reg put into place, or in this case, it would be a reg, you know, unput into place regulation, in the last 60 legislative days of an administration, that can be overturned by a simple majority in both houses. So they're really racing to do as much damage as they possibly can in as short amount of time as possible. And the latest outrage was the fuel efficiency standards that the Obama administration had put into place to try to raise fuel efficiency standards for cars. It was all eminently doable. But when your goal is to, you know, maximize oil consumption, which we've also seen during this administration, that, you know, what they're concerned about is how do we get aid to oil companies? You know, obviously, we're just not on the same wavelength. Let's put it that way.
Well, oil prices are at historic lows. Bill, are there specific ways that the oil industry is taking advantage of this crisis?
I'll tell you that the thing that really just about knocked me to the ground in the last week was watching what's happening out on the prairie with the Keystone Pipeline. You'll recall this story. A bunch of us fought for years to keep it from getting built. Obama said it couldn't be built. Trump overturned that as soon as he got into office. But the oil companies have never been able to build it because there have been too many people in the way. There are 30,000 people who have trained to do nonviolent civil disobedience to stop them if they tried. Well, this is their moment. And so the government of Alberta gave the pipeline company several billion dollars. Chase Bank followed with $1 billion from some other banks. The company said they were going to work, and in fact, they're flying in people from around the country, construction workers into rural areas that already have badly stressed healthcare systems, and on the edge of Indian reservations filled with people who lost 90% of their ancestors to pandemic over the last 500 years. This is an out-of-control machine, and it's doing damage right now. And of course, the bigger, larger damage it's doing is fueling the climate crisis that's going to just keep popping for decades to come, millennia to come.
You know, it's hard to say this, but the kind of shutdown, the frozenness of the globe at the moment has had some unintended consequences environmentally. You see these images taken from above about the way pollution has cleared up. You see photographs of the canals of Venice that are now absolutely clear, and you see fish in which you never would have seen before. All kinds of images like this, stories like this. Do you think that'll have any effect on the politics of climate change going ahead, Betsy?
Well, I think that's one of the many big questions of our moment. We are certainly seeing what we can do when we want to mobilize against a threat. You can say we've done it, you know, inadequately and too late, but we are doing a lot. And I think the question of our people, you know, really reexamining their core values, what do we need, and what don't we need, and seeing that we can live a lot differently. Now, the alternative argument can also be made that there'll be this huge rush to try to reinvigorate the economy in potentially the worst possible ways. So I honestly don't know. You know, the famous, I guess, Churchill, never let a crisis go to waste. I certainly hope that we will not let this crisis go to waste, but I don't know that we won't let it go to waste.
Bill, same question.
Well, look, there's a bunch of things that I think are sinking in. One, and this is really important, science is real and physical reality matters. You know, Betsy and I have spent decades trying to convince people that physics and chemistry are real, and you can't spin them and make them compromise and negotiate If that's true for the CO2 molecule, it's doubly true for the COVID microbe. And it doesn't matter how much the guy in Washington stands at his little lectern and waves his arms. It's not a hoax, and it's not going to go to zero in a few days, and it's not going to be over by Easter, and it's not, you know, on and on and on. The second lesson that I think people are learning, or maybe since we're now all epidemiologists, is time really matters. Like, we understand now that when the U.S. and South Korea got the first death, the South Koreans went to work. They disrupted life a little, told people to stop gathering in big groups, started testing people. And, you know, 6 or 8 weeks later, they're kind of looking at this through the rearview mirror. We did the opposite, and exactly as we did with climate change. We ignored the warnings for the 30 years. Now we're in over our heads. So maybe people will get the message that we have to go quickly if we're going to deal with these kind of threats.
Betsy, we're in the midst of a radical reshaping of the economy, or potentially we are. Are there any lessons that can be drawn from how this transition is being managed that can be applied to climate change and to how to avert the worst kind of catastrophe?
Well, I mean, a lot of parallels are being drawn to the Depression. The idea that we need, you know, a huge investment program in our country, whether you call it the Green New Deal, whether you call it an infrastructure bill that has clean energy at its center and clean transportation. I want to say we need huge changes to our transportation system. If we took that lesson and didn't just pour money into dying and or should be dying sectors of our economy, we would be in a much, much better place 10, 20, 30 years from now.
Bill, will the pandemic change the way that climate is talked about in the presidential election?
We'll see if anything else other than the pandemic is talked about in the presidential election. But I do think that it reinforces what was already a growing political sense that you have to take the physical world seriously.
For all of us, this period of staying at home requires some kind of personal deprivation, and we have to go without things that we've taken for granted. Here in the city, even just walking around is something that you think twice about. Is there some lesson for us in how we tackle climate change in terms of how we need to change our personal behavior to accept limitations?
I mean, there are huge, where are our major carbon emissions coming from? They're coming from the power sector and they're coming from the transportation sector. And one of the fastest growing parts of the transportation sector and one of the hardest to deal with in terms of getting us off fossil fuels has been air travel. And now we have no air travel. And so I think that is a really interesting question, whether our constant, you know, sort of flying around the world, which I am as guilty as anyone of, whether we just go back to business as usual or whether we do rethink some of those ways in which we've been living that cannot be sustained. I mean, they honestly simply just cannot be sustained. I do think for everyone, like it or not, you know, it has been this moment of reset and realizing, well, we don't need that. Now, once again, that is for me sitting here. I don't work for the airline industry. If you do, you obviously say, well, we need that. That's my job. So these are huge questions that will play out over the coming years.
Bill?
Well, look, first thing to be said is, and it draws on what Betsy just said, like the climate crisis, the corona pandemic has made it clear just what a horrible idea it is to have a deeply unequal society. And so I hope that one of the things that we take from this, and I trust we will, is that we can no longer continue to have a world where 5 or 6 people have as much wealth as hundreds of millions of other people. It doesn't work because those people, the poor people get sick and die. And it doesn't work because you can't have the kind of social trust you need to run a society. And that goes to the place that may be most important here, mean, what's the thing I think that most people miss above all is just the chance to be gregarious, to be with other people. Human beings are socially evolved primates. It wasn't that many generations ago that we were, you know, sitting on the floor of the savanna picking lice out of each other's fur, you know? And so it's hard to be told not to go touch people, hug people, be near people, talk to people, shake hands, all the things that we're used to. When we get out of detention, I hope that it will be a reminder to us about how much social distancing we've been doing already these last few decades, how much we've kind of retreated into a world of screens. And I think that we might, just might, prize each other a little bit more, and that if we do, we can begin to see how in that pleasure we might begin to replace some of the consumption that Betsy's been talking about and that drives every environmental challenge that we face. So who knows? I mean, it's also possible we'll just set up all the pins in the bowling alley again. That's the other possibility. But let's hope not. I think we're better than that.
Bill McKibben and Elizabeth Colbert, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, David.
Bill McKibben and Elizabeth Colbert. You can find both of their writings on the environment at newyorker.com, and in the same place, you can subscribe to our newsletter called The Climate Crisis, which Bill writes.